Welcome to Colorist Meetup, a podcast dedicated to professionals working with color for motion pictures. We meet to discuss the art and science of color grading. We learn about the latest developments and industry trends. We bring together the biggest names in color grading, breakthrough artists and trendsetters whose innovative work makes waves and sets industry trends. My name is Dado Valentic and I am fascinated with color. I am fortunate to have thought-provoking conversations with the most insightful people in the world when it comes to color. And in this podcast, I am sharing those conversations with you. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Colorist Meetup, a podcast where color grading is at the center stage. Our mission is to elevate the wonderful art and science of color grading and bring it to millions far outside the borders of Hollywood. What do Kanye West, The Weeknd, and Ariana Grande have in common? Well, apart from being world-class artists, they all grade their music videos with the same colorist. And what happens when you take this raw grading talent out of the music video world and put him in charge of the color of Apple Plus's prime TV show Greyhound? Well, you get a powerful creative mix that has led to an HPA nomination for the best color in the feature film category. And if this is not enough, this colorist has just been named 30 under 30 by Forbes magazine in section Art and Style, which is a historic nomination for any person working in post-production, not even to mention a nomination for a colorist. Ladies and gentlemen, I am proud to present Hollywood's next big color hit and one person to put on your watch list, Mr. Brian Smoller from Company 3. Brian, thank you very much for joining us today. I actually always feel so grateful to any colorist who gives up their time and decides to spend an hour or so talking to me, because I know, especially now at this time of the year, how busy it is. And first of all, I want to really thank you. And I want to thank you on behalf of our audience as well, because we are so excited to hear from you. You know, you're one of these colorists that you know, many people would like to know more about, but there is not enough that we can dig and hear about you. So I'm super, super grateful for you being a guest.
Well, hey, thank you so much for bringing me on your show. You know, I've been listening for the last couple of episodes and I'm super excited to be a part of these tremendous talents that you've had.
No, you know, this is you're just topping it up. I have to tell you, we're making the right trajectory. So, you know, especially the fact that, you know, you just got listed by Forbes as, you know, the how did they call it? The best 30 under 30. Yeah.
They describe it as the 30 most influential people under the age of 30 in art and style. So I'll take this. Art, but style, I don't know. I don't think my wife might disagree. At least when it comes to fashion.
Okay. I mean, this is the first time that they included colorist to begin with. Okay.
Or post-production. I mean, post-production. So when I heard about this, I was like extremely excited. But one thing I didn't expect was how many people reached out from the corners of post-production, editors, visual effect artists, and all these different people who said, this is like a small step for Brian, maybe. I'm not so sure. But it's a giant step for post-production and the visibility of the artistry that's behind these films, these music videos, these documentaries. And that was honestly more meaningful to me than anything, to know that I could play a role in bringing visibility to an art form that is as impactful and as relevant, but also as invisible as post-production artists have been.
I love that.
And I actually want to thank you on behalf of all of us for doing that.
Yeah, actually, you.
You know, I mean, I was gobsmacked. I was like, no, my God. And they categorized you really well. You know, I'm so happy you've gone into the art category, because this is the right category. You know, it's perfect. Amazing. So this is kind of, I really wanted to kind of use it as an opportunity to reach out to you, especially now. And then, but you know, like first question that I always ask, and I really like to start this with, is like, you know, how did you end up being one of the most influential, you know, artists in the world, like a 30 under 30? How did that happen? And how come you ended up becoming a colorist? This is always the most interesting part of this podcast, I find.
Well, I appreciate just the way you framed the question. You know, it's really nice of you. But I'll say that I don't know exactly how all this happened, but I can definitely point to a story that I think is fun to share. And we got nothing but time, so I'll give you the full version of the story without trying to bore you to tears. But I'm originally from Chicago. As you said, I'm 29. Being on the list, I needed to be. It just barely made that 30 list, being 29. Although, despite my age, I've been with Company 3 for 9 years.
Oh my God.
So I've been, I've been with Company 3 since I was 20, going to the company functions, wondering if I'll be judged if I drink a beer. You can imagine. And so I've been coloring for 12 years now, approximately. And, but with Company 3 for the last 9. And the way that if I were to go back to my beginning of finding film, I would go back to going into high school. And I knew that the public high school, Riverside Brookfield High School in the Chicago Western suburbs, public high school, like I said, and yet they had this huge television production program. I'm talking a full scale, multi-camera, live studio. Yeah. Yes. Like live on cable. For high school kids. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this looks like a freaking blast, right? My mom, she suggested I become a pharmacist, but I think this looks like potentially more fun than pharmacy. And so I remember going there, not knowing anything. Of course, that's how everyone would start. And I got super interested in the thrill of multi-camera direction, which leads me to single camera direction and putting together stories, putting together messages. And I loved everything from directing to editing to cinematography and everything in between. And while creating this work, I remember the very first project that I got paid to do, it was sort of in many ways more happenstance than deliberate, which was one of the first projects we were all assigned to do was to go out and create something for our channel. Go out and create. Most people went out and they shot short films. A lot of people went out and they shot music videos. And I was like, okay, well, why don't I go find a not-for-profit company that has really no platform to spread their message? I'll just go over to them. And this is my pitch. I'm like, and the place is called People Care Incorporated. This is hardly a shout out because I'm not so sure they're still around. But, and I said, hey guys, my name's Brian. I just turned 14. I'd love to direct the commercial for you. Probably won't be very good, but it won't cost you anything. And people will see it if you want them to. There's my pitch. Take it or leave it.
And you included
that's a hard 14. Bargain.
Wait, you included this line that I am 14, right?
Oh, yeah, God. Right. And so it was a class project. And so I did this with as if it was a professional project. And I remember at the end of it, they, without it, any solicitation, they just gave me a $250 thank you check. And I'm like, holy smokes, this is no joke. You know how many, I can buy video games at full price with $250. This is super exciting. And this wasn't something that I did for the money. I did it for class, but even the efforts weren't inspired or encouraged by the prospect of a good grade. This was just fun to do. And I was doing it with my friends. And I was like, but this is actually a business. Okay, let's see. Are there other opportunities? Are there other places, people who want this kind of work that'll pay me hundreds to direct, produce, shoot, edit, and do everything in between? Right, I guess, too. Right. And so my next client was Reader's Digest, where we had in Chicago.
But wait, Digest is a big company.
I know. Well, get this. You'll figure out how this niche was so perfect. Was I went to, I knew that they were doing these magazine drives. A lot of people from certainly the Western, from the Midwest might know what this is. And this is basically where I go out representing the school, this is where middle school students would go out representing their school saying, hey, going door to door, trying to sell magazine subscriptions. And in return, these kids would get like toys and scooters. And every week they'd get little prizes, right? Oh. Kind of like Girl Scout cookies, but for the whole school and magazines. And I went to Reader's Digest, having known them from done it a couple of years prior, just as a student, as a middle school kid. I said, hey, you guys should do weekly videos where you encourage the kids to sell magazines this week, and nobody's voice would be more influential than a big adult kid who's 14 who can speak unprofessionally. I mean, I'll do my best, but I'm going to speak I can speak to the voice of these essentially kids who are only a couple years younger than me. So would you guys be interested in having me make these like announcement videos that you guys would do? And they're like, whoa, like we never thought of that. Like, yeah, let's do that. Let's give that a shot. And so from there, I started building up a little bit of, you know, confidence and skill as I would go through both these professional projects and doing it through class. And to the point where I was like, I need like gear. I need like a crew
so far
to satisfy school, these jobs are getting bigger and bigger.
So using the school facility to make all of this.
Yeah. Until eventually I would grow out of the capability or the gear and the equipment that the school would provide resources for. And I went to Magnanimous Media, which is now a very popular rental house in Chicago. And I said, guys, I'm 16. This is my mom's car out front. I don't have a credit card. I don't have any of this, but I would love to borrow $50,000 of gear and pay to borrow it, which is eventually, and they're like, they were just then starting up. And they're like, okay, this scrappy kid who like, do you have anything to prove to us that you're not going to destroy our equipment? And I'm like, well, I've got like a reel that I cut from these smaller projects. And as soon as they're like, okay, sure. And I like, now I've got a relationship with a rental house that just gave me, with no collateral, just a promissory note, basically. And I'm like, now I have like access to real gear. I can go out and like make a business. And so that's what I started doing. I started doing like, I used to do like projects for Pagani Hair, and I would learn about balayage and strangely. I also learned about the other kind of colorist, someone who does hair. And I was do all these kinds of smaller projects. I had jobs for Walgreens, all this during my early high school years.
Wow.
And so while I was considering, okay, what do I want to do when I'm out of high school? Mm-hmm. You know, I like this directing thing. This is really fun. Being from the Midwest, I don't know a soul who doesn't go to work every day. This is bizarre. And even while I was doing this directing, I started working as a waiter at Baker Square. And I would make far more money directing than I was as a waiter, but it just felt wrong to not have a job that I went to every day. So this is just to put you in my mindset of not knowing where this is going. And so I was like, I think I want to be an editor. This is my favorite part of that process. While directing, shooting, editing, and doing everything in between was really fun. A career working on real projects, I saw my talents and my passions and my long-term success to be in editing. And so I started learning visual effects, and I went off to college, first at Columbia College, Chicago, moved to Hofstra University, and while I was in New York. And then when I was in New York, I started working in editorial. And by now I had already done visual effects and editorial, but that was the first time that I attended a color session.
That was in New York in some post facility.
Yeah, it was at Nice Shoes in New York.
Oh my God. I remember that place. Yeah. That was beautiful. I remember them. Hey, but wait. So, but how did you learn? You said, okay, I started learning visual effects and all of this. How, I mean, what does it mean? Like, you know, you started learning. Is this like
a... Yeah. Yeah. So I could rent gear. I could rent camera equipment for these professional shoots because I had budgets that went along with them. But the only thing I owned was a really lousy Hi8 camera. and not even good for the time, to be honest. I would just capture that footage, you know, FireWire 400 style into my computer. And I was like, okay, I want to like learn visual effects. And how do I do that? Well, let's look on the internet. And I remember one of my early heroes, Andrew Kramer, would post the, that's probably a big throwback.
Andrew Kramer.
What a dream it would be for him to hear what I'm this shout out right here.
I my God, he was the, you know, I could not believe that he was even making those tutorials for free and what you were able to do with After Effects.
Oh, yeah.
Inspired generations to do stuff, right?
Yes.
It was crazy.
Yeah, I mean, he inspired me at age 15 to go out with my high camera, shoot video of like the town hall, bring that footage back home and make it look like town hall was exploding.
Yes.
Or I would have another thing. I didn't even have like fake guns, but I had like a banana, and I would have footage of me like throwing a banana at my cousin and hitting them in the head, and their head would explode as soon as the banana hit their head. Like, these are the kinds of ways. This wasn't me pursuing a career. This was me having fun. This is me just noodling around with things that I was learning online.
Oh my God. And being hit by the car. This was another tutorial. I remember.
Oh, yeah. I did another short film where I had to, I didn't want to tell that I needed a little girl to get hit by a car. I don't know. That sounded like the most dramatic thing I could think of. And so you could use Andrew's footage, but it was way more fun for me to go out and shoot my own and try to learn from it myself. And so I told the mom, hey, she needs to do these weird like positions so that I can make it look like she's being hit by a car. I don't want to freak her out. And so I remember, you know, this is, you're bringing me back to the days where I just would have a whole ton of fun just learning how to do this stuff with no agenda whatsoever.
I love it. So wait, so you go then into New York, nice shoes, and you see the color grading session and that sparks an interest, right?
So here's what happens. I'm at Nice Shoes. I don't remember the name of the artist. I remember I got there early and I didn't even know what you're supposed to say. Are you supposed to say hello? Like, no one told me if I'm supposed to say hello. And I'm sitting in the color session and the colorist thinks I'm the client, and I haven't necessarily clarified either, but I'm just there to observe. I'm essentially an intern or assistant editor somewhere in between. And I'm there and we're there. This is the most simple color session. We're there for a 1 hour color session doing an HD retransfer, which used to be a pretty, you know, 12 years ago, this was like a lot of color sessions. What we were doing was we were just scanning commercials that were already graded in SD and we're retransferring them into HD and making it look the same essentially. And so the job here was for Docolax constipation medicine. Yeah, this is what started a career. It started with constipation. And I remember being there with the agency and with the editorial, and everyone there is like kind of bored. And I'm there eyes wide looking at this guy color the hell out of this constipation medicine commercial. And I can't believe, and I'm learning how much creative license and liberty and he's taking on a very technical job, but I can see the potential and how indirectly the client had to speak to the colorist. And this was like, wow, I get everything I love about editorial, seeing a project to its final stages, putting a bow on it, having something that's like a finished show at the end. And then everything I loved about cinematography from high school and photography all in one. And get this is at a time when color correction was transitioning, early stages of transitioning from every job being shot on film and hung on a spirit to every job now being scanned, still scanned, and then being done in DI. And then, of course, the Red was a near unusable camera around that time, but it was right around the corner. This all happened over those couple of years. And so it was super exciting to see, look around and notice, wait a minute, color correction is not only an art form I wasn't aware of, but it's also an art form that's going to go through, it was going through significant changes and significant transition as it gets closer and closer to visual effects, closer than any other time prior. Mm-hmm. That was something that I wanted to be a part of. not just be a colorist, but also be a member of a community that's transitioning this technology for the best, the better of storytelling.
And then you know what? We're still on that ride. Actually, it has to slow down. Interestingly, you know.
Yeah.
It's still changing. It's still going.
It's true.
Yeah. Okay. So wait, so how did you? What was your then the first tool you picked up to start learning color grading? After Effects?
Yeah. Yeah. You guessed it. That's exactly right. It was After Effects. And by now, I mean, by now, I had already been dabbling in color in the same way that I'm dabbling in visual effects, and I'm doing color correction. But I'm reaching over for Apple Color, scratching my head, can't figuring out why I would use this instead of After Effects, and I'm doing all my color correction in After Effects because that's what I was comfortable with, and not knowing that I'm actually, in many ways, I felt like I was doing myself a disservice by not using a color tool. But in practice, I'm actually doing myself a service of not only building an eye for it, but also thinking about color correction in an previously unconventional way, which today it looks a lot more familiar. So yeah, it was just being done in After Effects. And even as I transitioned to being just a colorist, early stages before Resolve was available, I was using Automatic Duck to stack timelines in After Effects and building grades.
So basically doing a lot of layers, blending modes as well, masks, tracking that and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And using I'm trying to remember exactly how it was structured, but it was essentially, I'd have a timeline, which was just looked like a staircase on After Effects. And if I needed to do, yeah, exactly. Right. And I would use Automatic Duck because that was a free tool that could move you from Avid or Final Cut or Premiere directly over to After Effects. And then I would build essentially color corrections that were both, which were both shot to shot pre-comped, color corrections, as well as like layer based or scene based color corrections, which my own little system that I wasn't really learn. I was only learning through the tools that I understood and dabbling in ways that made sense to me.
Oh wow! Okay, so did you end up when did Color Company 3 happen? Did you work anywhere before, or did you just landed there?
Yeah, I worked at a couple of places. So now I'm like, okay, hard pivot. I'm a colorist. This is what I want to do, right? And so I started, while I'm looking out and I'm building a client base, which is something that was actually pretty easy to do in college when nobody was a colorist. Everyone wanted, that was something the DPs did, but didn't want to do. And so there's a college in that way was rewarding in that I got to work on a lot of films. And while doing that, I knew I needed to transition from the television world television commercial world from in New York to Los Angeles. And so I transferred at that point to Chapman University. And during that summer on my way to Los Angeles, I worked over at Red Car Chicago and Optimus in Chicago with Tyler Roth, who I now work with. Yeah. Who I now work with at Company 3 LA.
So he moved now to LA.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Tyler and I worked together in Chicago, and he went off and started Company 3 Chicago while I was moving over to Company 3 LA. And in there, I also had maybe 6 months of doing 4K telecine because I knew in another capacity. As my last hurrah of just really doing classical telecine transfer.
Yeah. But that's a good training.
I'm glad that I got to do it. And it certainly set me apart as I was having conversations with Company 3.
Yeah. And that's really like, because you know, they're doing transfers, you just learn how to be fast, you know, that's a kind of one thing. And you know, your three-way color corrector, you know, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think mine might've been even more rudimentary. Maybe it's exactly what you're describing. It was just a bones interface where I had just three knobs and I had the it might have been six for the red, green, and blue highlights and shadows. And it would have been while I'm like standing at an uncomfortably small computer screen with my head craned to the left looking at what the hell I'm doing. Like that was the It wasn't anything more complicated.
Important
than that.
Is you have to
the
do
most,
it fast.
The most impressive thing was that it was a 4K spirit. That was really what was cool about it. Yeah.
Right. So quickly measure your black density, your black point. Let's go.
Yeah. Right.
I know those days. I mean, but you know, but that kind of, you know, pressure of scanning and working fast is something that it's super, I find that people who come from that background, if there's one thing is they stop overthinking, you know, they're like kind of just
yes.
running, you know? So, okay. So then wait. So you're basically doing some scanning. You worked some, you know, helping out with a couple of companies, doing some experience. And now you're at Chapman in Los Angeles, still studying effectively, right?
Yeah, I'm a junior at Chapman in LA. Chapman, Orange County, for the people who are in LA, you know, that's Orange, the city of Orange in Orange County, being 2 hours away from Company 3. And I'm a junior and I'm applying to work at Company 3. I know I'm only in LA to meet people in LA. I'm really not there to get good grades. That would be a bonus. So here's what's going on is I end up getting hired. And at this point, there's no precedent for an assistant. I get it being hired as an assistant, to be clear. And there's, at this point, there's no precedent for an assistant to become a colorist at this time. And I knew that this was going to be an uphill battle. And likely at the time I went in with the expectation that this battle might require that I transition to another company. But I wanted to learn from the best. And I wanted to learn by working alongside the people that I've been looking up to. I should also clarify that, of course, around this time, Resolve had already come out. So I'd already been very familiar with Resolve around this time. And Company 3 was transitioning to Resolve, to the software, you know, DaVinci Resolve outside of just doing spirits. So it was a little bit more, it was like maybe 2/3 of the color sessions were Resolve and maybe 1/3, maybe less, were hanging film.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're still very early on, you got access to the kind of very early version of the software Resolve, the actual, you know, software, the Linux version back then, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I'm still on Linux, but yeah, exactly.
Oh, no.
Yeah. We're on Linux. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I'm on the Linux version and I'm learning the color. And so now I'm sitting at a set of panels on off hours and it's literally the 2K Spirit panel operating the DaVinci Resolve software, and none of the buttons are labeled correctly. And even the ones that are even have a label, well, they're, you know, mechanical keys, and they've since, you push some of them and they'll flip off. You'll push them a little too hard and they'll fling up into the air and go over your shoulder. And that's of course why they've been rearranged on the panels. And I've got to be like, what do I have to do? Yellow diamond. And then the button that's not labeled down to the right of the yellow diamond, like what the heck? And so I'm literally learning color correction by not looking down, because there's no reason to look down because none of the buttons are labeled. Yeah. And so it was around that time, you know, that they were starting to slowly roll out these advanced panels, which the colorists one by one would warm up to.
Uh-huh.
And at that same time,
I never warmed up, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, how can you even look back?
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah. Crazy.
And yeah. And I needed to learn both sets of panels because, you know, it didn't, I wasn't going to be, if I was ever going to color there, I knew I wasn't going to be the one to like push around. Like I need to work on these panels, even though there's fewer of them. Of course not. I'm going to learn both.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So at this time, get this, I'm still a junior. I'm going to school full time in Orange County, 2 hours away. And I'm working at Company 3, 60 hours a week.
My God!
At the same time,
doing night shifts, assisting or daytime. What were you doing? Like
evening night shift during the week, and then weekend days.
Wow!
So that way, it's 7 days. I mean, it's just do the math. I mean, it was insane. Even I can't quite imagine how I did this for a year and a half. By the way, because I wasn't wrapping up my chat. And of course, Company 3 is kind of encouraging that I reconsider staying in school. I've got the job. Why am I in school? And I'm in class. So I'm kind of feel like I've stretched in at Company 3, but I'm also not, I'm stretched in at school. So I felt like at the time, and I'm supporting my freelance clients. So I'm doing all three of these. I'm doing freelance color correction. I'm doing company three assist work, and I'm doing going to school full time. And I'm literally to the point where I'm starting off the first day of every class, telling my professors, "Hey, just want to let you know now, I'm not gonna do everything. I'm not going to do all the homework." And I don't want it to be misconstrued as a reflection on the way I feel about you as a professor or the way I feel about the class. It's just something that there's not enough hours in the day. And most of the professors did not like that, but I felt better having shared it rather than keep it to myself. And I'm alive. Everyone survived. You know, the stakes didn't need to be as high as they may have felt, right? But ultimately, it did come to the point where about a year and a half later, where I'm stretched so thin for so long that I was just like, "Hey, I've got this one short film. I know Cutters is cutting it. I know Sony Colorworks, another throwback, is doing the finishing. Someone else is doing the effects work." All these of which I knew were relationships Company 3 had been protecting. I said, "Is there any way I can color this job off hours for nothing? You don't even have to pay me, nothing for me, and I'll get the client to pay Company 3 10 times what you pay me, you know?" Yeah. And they're like, "Okay, well, we can't have you work for no money." And Todd Brown was the managing director at the time. And he's like, "But we can, so we're going to pay you to do this. But yeah, we'll let you do this project." And And they opened the floodgates. Well, you said it this one time, and so I don't take any of this for granted. That's why I'm saying it with a good spirit. But I mean, that was really at that moment when I just had no choice, but I just told all my clients to call Company 3 essentially and ask for me. And this was a gutsy move, and it's not one that I would suggest today, because I mean, while it worked out, it was the kind of move you do when you're young and you don't know better. Let's put it that way. Right.
But hang on a second, if I was to your client, let's say I'm working with you, right? And you suddenly tell me, "Hey, you know, you now can book me via Company 3, right?" It would mean, okay, I probably have to pay more, right? Isn't it? Because Company 3 is going to charge me the rates. But at the same time, I'd be like, "Oh my God, you know, the guy I was betting on now got," because Company 3 was Company 3 from the moment they started. Let's face it. You know, it wasn't just like, "Oh, I'm just grading for this little shop somewhere in Orange County." Yeah. You're working for Company 3. So that kind of, it's even a huge recognition. So I'd be like, you know, the colorist I believed in is now becoming a really big name colorist because he's now where, you know. So I actually think this is, for me as a client, if I was your client, I'd be like, I would be really happy about it. I'd be like, okay, I don't mind even paying more because I think I'm going to be working with a person I like and I'm going to be getting much better work out of it.
Yeah, well.
Working for a big company.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of people probably saw it that way, but and the reality is that most people just couldn't pay it because those are the kinds of people I was working with, and frankly, I didn't have the time to do every project anyway. So there was sort of the selection process worked itself out in that way. And while I should also give another shout out, while I'm at Company 3 now as a senior and coloring like short films through Company 3, Walter from Company, well, now who was then at the time at Photochem, was teaching a class at Chapman, which I attended. And so I was saying, I'm going to work at Company 3 full time and then driving back down to Chapman University to take Walter's class, wondering and kind of being a little coy that I already work at Company 3 because I don't want him to have any preconceived notion about whether or not I'm here to learn. And I know he's a guy to learn a heck of a lot from. He's a great teacher and he's someone that's continued that message.
Oh my God. No way.
Yeah.
And you never told him? Did you ever tell him actually?
Oh no, he found out quick. I think someone else in the room brought it up and it was like a Harry Potter at Hogwarts moment when everyone turns around and Walter's like, "What are you talking about? You work at Company 3. I thought you were you go to school in Orange County.
Oh my god, man. This is crazy, man. This is super crazy. Yeah,
he didn't hold it against me. But now he's with.
He's with you because through e-film he got back to Company 3.
Yeah, right?
Exactly. I see. So this is why he's such a good teacher, because he's been teaching already. I wondered, because you know, I saw him once, you know, invited him once to kind of do like a meetup, you know, in person, you know, like when we were doing it like back before COVID and stuff. And, you know, he was amazing, you know, like there was the best audience ever I think he could have had. And then he delivered this amazing tutorial about a fixed note tray. Actually, I changed the way how I work today because of that. You know, I was like, oh my God, you know, this guy, you know, he's very good at explaining, you know, he's great.
Yeah.
No? Oh my God. Okay. So wait. So I want to hear, this is just getting better and better and better. I can't believe what I'm hearing here. Okay. So, but then, you know, you kind of made yourself a name with music videos, isn't it? This is really where, you know, I want to understand that, you know, how did you manage to get all these big artists, you know, that are like not just big in terms of like, you know, how many records they sell, but big in terms of, you know, how creatively they're pushing their music videos. They use their music videos as their main tool. It's not like, I'm just going to make a great record and make a music video. No, I'm going to make a music video first, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how did you get them to choose you and find you and also stick with you for all these years? I mean, how did that happen?
My loyalty is to the filmmakers, and everything else is secondary. Just having that simplistic focus on what can I do for the directors, for the DPs, for the producers to make their jobs easier and more fun. That North Star allowed me to build a slow, and it feels slow, but steady snowball effect of loyal filmmakers who want to be working with me. And we're having good times doing projects together. And this turns into, you know, you work with one DP and he introduces you to a producer and a director. And if you make them all thrilled with what you did, you work your tail off, and you do good work that you stand behind, then now you've turned one client to three clients, and those guys will go off and work with new DPs, directors, and producers. And that's sort of how it builds slowly. And so it can feel, when you're very young in your career, it can feel like everyone else is working with all these cool people but you. But that's because going from one client to three clients, when you compare yourself, is now I have three clients, that feels like very insignificant. But today I'm not tripling my client base in one session. Right. So the takeaway here is, if you're loyal to the filmmakers, to the creatives, to the voices behind the stories that you're telling, that everything else will organically work itself out over time.
I hear you. And I have to tell you, like, you know, I have done similar what you were doing, but I also have fallen on my face once, you know, because I was just juggling too many balls, right? Trying to do too many jobs, right? And at one moment to really like a client that I liked a lot, I, not deliberately, maybe I was just too tired. You know, it was another one of those days, night shifts and this and that. And I didn't do a job well, you know what I mean? Like, because it was just, you know, not you know, I didn't deliver the best. Okay. And the problem was that he walked away not telling me this, you know, he just walked away kind of says, thank you, but not thank you effectively. Right. And I almost lost him as a friend as well, you know, like, because we were like, he was like disappointed that, you know, so thankfully I managed to find out it wasn't happy. And I came clear. I said, look, I'm so sorry. It wasn't, I had a bad day. Everyone has a bad day. Everybody now and then screws up. And I have done a bad day that day. I admit, and I kind of managed to rebuild that relationship, but it took me a while, you know, to get him to feel confident that he wants to grade with me again. So, you know, I don't know, how do you handle that pressure, you know, because everybody who comes to you, like, you know, wants to get the best out of you, you know, and how are you handling, you know, juggling all these kind of people, like, you know, and making them, you know, happy one after another, you know, where do you get this inspiration and motivation from?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as you're sharing that story, I think that I'm not alone in the people who are listening to you. In we can all relate with that story. Mm. And I have examples of the same thing where I won't even know until in hindsight that there are ways that I could have improved that service. And sometimes Instagram makes the way you feel pernicious. It really can be it can really affect you from the inside, and you try to shake it off. But because the only thing you want to be taking away is, what could you do better? You don't want to be taking all the toxicity that comes from that along with it. Well, here's one thing that I think is probably known, but under acknowledged or under recognized, is that people will almost never remember what happened, but they will always remember how they felt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The source of our stress in all walks of life, but in particular, you know, you can see how this manifests in color correction. The source of our stress is when our expectations of what ought happen don't match the reality of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so a lot of the stress that I'll find will be if, you know, there's a technical problems and we're having lots of technical problems and it's affecting my day, and my day's super packed. So I know that my schedule is going to have a compounding effect, and this is stressing me out because I'm concerned about not having enough time to do a great process. That's like
classic colorist
stress. And you know, and it's easy to get frustrated, especially because when you don't have enough time, you stop eating, and when you stop eating, you stop being particularly articulate.
Hungry. They call it hangry. Right?
Yeah.
Hangry.
You get hangry. I think that's the technical term. Yeah. And your clients will feel it, especially if they're with you in the room. And, but one, you know, it's both therapeutic, meditative, and helpful to just remind myself, we are not saving lives here. And I tell this just to myself. And the reason why is because if I can lower the stakes, I can afford myself the point of view and that North Star, that if anything happens here, I just need to make sure the client feels good.
Mm.
This is not ideal. Mm. Nothing about this process is ideal for whatever is happening in that circumstance. Mm-hmm. But as long as the client feels good, you've done what you can. And so let's put it this way. And I'm not trying to belittle the value of great color correction. I'm just trying to show you the context by which great color correction manifests itself. Mm-hmm. If I have a freaked out client and he's freaked out about some problem, let's say the artist has or the studio has, and all I do is I just quickly fix it. And let's say I do an amazing job and I quickly fix it, but they feel like I rushed it. And even if the work is good, if they don't feel good about it, you're going to be changing everything. And then what makes it on the screen won't be its best version of itself. The artistry of color correction is found between you and that client. The artistry of color correction, not just the craft, not just the necessary politics, the actual art that makes it on the screen is a manifestation of the process itself. So to become a great colorist, to become a great artist, is to become a great people person, a good politician, a great collaborator.
Mind reader.
Yeah, a great mind reader, but also a great mind leader, a thought leader, you know, that can manifest itself.
Control
yeah.
room. But did you have anybody
control
like
the room.
That you learned from, or how, you know, I mean, how did you develop that kind of, you certainly have it, you know, I mean, I'm
sure.
Not just talking to you, you're controlling it perfectly, like to me. So
yeah, I'm controlling you. Great.
Yeah, totally. I'm so enjoying it. And I would love to work with you, you know, just because there is a kind of excitement, you know, you're so like,
yeah.
you know, like, So did you have anybody who taught you? Did you have a mentor or somebody?
Yeah. Yeah. When I think of, I've got a lot of people I look up to. I mentioned Tyler earlier because he was one of the first colorists that I not just watched color, but actually got to know. And so you get to know like the person behind the color, behind the title. And then coming to company three, I got to meet big personalities like Stefan, of course, who will, I mean, if someone knows how to run a room, it's him.
And, more than one at the same time, actually, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, and that's something that him being good at running a room makes it on the screen. That's kind of why he gets away with pulling, you know, he can create these tremendous looks. It's, if he wasn't good at running a room, those looks wouldn't have made it on the screen.
Yeah.
Even if, you know, and so, and then other people that I would learn from are Siggy for finding ways to go back to visual effects and to go back to maximizing the tools that are at our disposal. Siggy is fantastic at staying at the cutting edge of what these tools are capable of, in many cases, literally leading the edge of what should come next in these tools and finding creative ways to implement them. And I can go on and go through each colorist and describe how their personality and their approach has influenced the way I consider color correction. But another way that I think, I would say probably the largest way that my style and my taste and my approach to this craft has been manifest has been with the people that I work with and the people I gravitate towards. Mm-hmm. Meaning it's literally the kinds of, like, if you think of like the most basic example that I'm just coming up with off the cuff, it's like, how, Brian, did you come up with like great skin tones? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, it's because I've had 600 clients tell me that it's a little too green. And then I over time find out that my color is a little too green, not deliberately or literally, but it's something that I can look back and acknowledge. And then I get a bunch of whole new clients that say now they're a little too magenta. And sometimes you agree, sometimes you disagree, and your taste, it emerges from that collaborative process. So when people come to me and they say, Brian, like, how do you describe your style? It is not easy for me to describe my style in the way that I would, while I don't know this, I would expect it to be difficult for Roger Deakins to describe his own style. It's easier for other people to describe
your style.
Outward looking in. What's my style? I'd like all of my images to look good and for them to support the story. Like that's what's going through my head, right?
But you have something. Okay, so let me give you my view of your style,
yeah,
which is something very, please. I know, you do have a level of hyperrealism in your grades. Mm. If you know, especially your music videos, you know, mm-hmm. I find that, you know, there is like almost like a gloss kind of that, you know, as if you like sprayed some sort of, you know, like something that gives like such a beautiful finish. You feel like you want to pause the frame and print it out. You know what I mean? This is how kind of things just feel so beautiful and so polished. And also I feel like, you know, you use the full dynamic range and spectrum. I think, you know, like you're kind of, you know, on a brimming with color and contrast. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like there is no space to squeeze anything more in. You just feel like, and also I love your separation. You know, like, you know, you love your complementaries kind of, you know, there is such a clean kind of, you know, like a palette there. There is no complicated kind of muddy, you know, like a Swedish style northern kind of, you know, stuff. At least not in music videos that I've seen that you graded. You know what I mean? Like things are just grabbing you. You know, you have definitely, you know, something that I feel like, okay, you know, you're giving those videos this incredible finished, polished look. That's what I feel like it is, right? It's like a top shelf, right?
Yeah, well, thank you.
So, Brian, even though like most people, you know you like, you know, through the music videos or how I kind of, you know, got to know you like is through the music videos, actually is a kind of little known fact that you have already graded, you know, more than 30 features, isn't it?
One of the most rewarding parts of being on the Company 3 team and having such a great support staff has been that I get to work on all these disciplines. I get to work as a colorist on features, television, music videos, and everything in between, commercials. And what this has meant that I get to flex different muscles when I work on each of these disciplines. When I'm working on a music video, we spoke a little bit about I'm there to amplify the voice and the feeling and the mood of that song. Mm-hmm. When I'm here working on a feature, my North Star, my ambition is to get in the head of the protagonist, understand their point of view, mm-hmm. and then externalize the way they feel about their environment. Mm-hmm. If I can understand mm-hmm. my main character and figure out how they feel about where they are and illustrate that on the screen, I can bring the viewer along for a ride where they will see through the point of view of that character.
Of course. More
to give you kind of an example of that, you could think of like a forest. Like, let's say you have a character in a forest and that you know that your character can be with a bunch of friends who each feel differently about being in this forest, but your protagonist feels scared, overwhelmed, lost in this forest. Well, I'm going to have that in my head as I'm coloring this forest to make it feel threatening, to make mm-hmm. it feel intimidating. Whereas maybe I have the exact same footage, but the story is different. And the headspace of my protagonist is that they're on an adventure. They're excited. I'm going to go ahead and take this same footage, same big ball light in the sky, and use color correction to communicate that spirit of adventure, to communicate that enthusiasm for nature or whichever headspace or perspective that protagonist is in. That's something that's super fun about narrative that I really love.
I want to talk about the Greyhound. And, you know, it was one of those grades where, you know, when a trailer finished, like there is a little silence, you know, where everybody's just kind of still taking the, you know, surviving the emotion. and I was like, this is huge. This is big. You know, like, you know, the look, the feel, everything was just telling, screaming at me, this is theatrical. And it was actually Lynette, you know, she said to me, oh no, Apple bought it, you know, it's gonna go on streaming. And we almost felt like, oh no, this, there was a COVID, so I don't think they were able to make it theatrical. So tell me please about it, because that is such an iconic kind of movie, you know, that is such a beautiful film. And you know, working on Tom Hanks as well, I mean, you're kidding me. This must have been like a dream job. You know, how did it come to you? How did that happen? You know, tell me a little bit about that.
This is a wild ride, and it includes everything from creative challenges to technical ones and everything in between. And I'll tell you, where do I even begin? I mean, I guess I begin by just briefly mentioning that Sonnenfeld and I were working on the film a year prior to me grading it, only in the capacity of doing a grade to help receive finishing funds to do the visual effects, so, and to test the film. And so I worked on the movie, you know, a year prior to me actually being the colorist on the film. And a year later, in that time, during that year, they're doing visual effects. And so then, you know, approximately 9 months later, I'm at the ASC Awards and Jill Bondagnewitz introduces me to Shelley Johnson, a tremendously successful and talented cinematographer. And he follows me on Instagram, right? And he's like, Brian, like, I've got this movie. He doesn't even know I've worked on it. I've got this movie. And it's a Tom Hanks film. And he explains to me that he's largely overseeing the DI at this point. And he asks if I want to be a part of it, knowing that it's got some history with the studio, and he would love to like put me up for it. And I'm like, oh, like, are you talking about this movie Greyhound? He goes, like, what? Like, how would you know that? And I'm like, I worked on this movie a year prior. He says, you're kidding me. You're kidding me. He's like, oh my God, the studio's going to love that. You know?
And, oh my God, he was worried if he could sell to you to the studio.
Yeah, yeah. Because exactly. No, 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 and I'm like, no, this is going to be like, let's do this. This is going to be a fantastic film. I've seen it, you know? Like, I'm not wondering if it's going to be a good movie. And so I get attached to the project. This is before Apple has anything. This is before COVID. I mean, think about this. When's the AFC Awards? Is that... February?
Yeah.
January. Yeah, probably January.
Yeah, January. We'll see. Yeah, I remember that they are like an off season for the other awards, you know. So they're okay. So probably, I'm not sure exactly, but
okay. Well, it's either top of the year, end of the year. It's right around that point. But it's in either December 2019, but I think January 2020. And so that's when I start coloring this movie in like February of 2020. You could probably see where this is going. Mm-hmm. And so, right. And so I'm coloring this movie. It's a theatrically released film. Like the Sony is doing the film. It's going to come out in May in theaters. And it's a big picture. And it's, I mean, Tom Hanks wrote the script. He's the executive producer. And I'm coloring this movie in the theater. We're setting looks. It's going great. We're early in the stages. And then right around the time when after we had set the look, but maybe, I don't know, 5% of the movie has been colored, COVID happens. I'm getting calls and hearing murmurs that we might need to just shut down our facility to all supervised, well, to all clients. I mean, we didn't know what exactly that meant, to all clients. And I'm like, no, we can't do that. Because this is early, you know, I'm talking first week or so of March. I'm like, no, we're not going to shut down the clients. Like, that's insane. I can't lose this movie. That's crazy. And that's preposterous. I've been there 9 years. We've never closed the facility. And they're like, well, maybe we'll have you color unsupervised. I'm like, yeah, right. It was hard enough to get me on the film. Now I'm trying to like convince the filmmaker like to not come in. That's crazy. And so we closed down for COVID. And I'm just sitting here in silence. No color hours are being scheduled. I'm moving on actually to coloring other projects that had been shot before the pandemic, the quarantine began. And I'm just not hearing about Greyhound booking any time. And I'm getting very nervous. And it starts rolling around like, okay, now we're in April. Now we're like approaching the end of April, as I recall. And I'm like, okay, this movie's not going to get colored by May. Like, what's going on? What's going on? Sitting over here wondering, is another colorist already coloring? Right?
No.
And then I find out, sure enough, I get the call from Shelley. He tells me that Apple bought the film. And it's going to come out in July. So they're pushing it back a few months. It's a relief. Uh-huh. And this is going to be Apple's first feature film that they're they bought a small Sundance film.
Their P&A budget was bigger than anything they ever had. Yes, it was their way how to get the Apple Plus out there. It was
This is their big push. Is their first big entry into feature filmmaking. I'm like, you know what? So at first, like, we're kind of wrestling with, is this like a devastating fact or is this actually like a blessing in disguise? Way more people are going to see this movie. While we would love everyone to see a war film on the big screen, this might be actually a blessing in disguise. And so we jump in. And so again, this is a movie that's a third of its colored maybe. And I'm now having to pivot to HDR.
Going to ask you, because that changes not just, we are just going to, make a master. No, it's changing everything because
and they're not HDR granting first. Me 4 hours or something. They're like, no, just keep going in another color space, another gamma, just do it there. I'm like, okay, well.
And
this
how
goes
Shelley
back
about
to the beauty.
HDR? What is his experience with HDR? He loves it?
None.
Oh no.
And get this. I mean, Dado, like he didn't even have, I mean, he can't even come in. Right. So now I'm told we're going to switch this movie from P3 theatrical, lights off, dark, to HDR and the client won't get to come in and see it. We're going to do a virtual to his SDR iPad.
And he never saw it HDR, never done HDR.
Well, I mean, he did eventually, but like, we're still in the early creative stages of this film. Oh. That's what I'm getting at.
And you know, old school cinematographers hate HDR, like sometimes, you know, like they just run away from it as if it's, you know, like they, you know, they think it kills the picture. You know what I mean? They're so anti sometimes. Oh my God. So wait, wait. So
well, and I don't know if I'm going to be up against that because he didn't have any HDR experience at that time.
Right, right, right.
Right. And I did. So I did know how to get the most out of HDR. And I think that if you're drawing a broad brush on that HDR kills pictures, you clearly have not, you've not had a very good demonstration of what HDR is. I mean, if HDR is nothing but the more crayons, you could just use the same crayons. If you really want it to be.
The problem is that most cinematographers get introduced to HDR by watching Sony monitors demo videos, which are like, you know, over the top, you know what I mean? Like you just go like, this is not an image, guys. Who would ever shoot anything like this? You know? That's the problem, you know? They kind of think like, oh, unless it's 1,000 nits, it's not a shot. And you just, oh, I know. You know, like that's exactly. The problem. That's the problem, you know, because and that's what scared them off, you know? It's really terrible. Okay. Yeah. So I saw it in HDR, by the way. And it looked like, you know, I love HDR. When I look at it, it doesn't look like HDR. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It looks beautiful. And you don't really look at it and go like, oh, it looks like HDR. No, it looks like
right.
Big movie. And especially what I love, you know, about it is the shadow. I mean, that movie has got this very particular contrast, which is so important for this kind of war type of movies. You know, there is like something like, you know, chunky in that shadow, but you can still see it in the detail, you know? And I think that actually HDR really worked well for it.
Yes. Yeah. You know, the irony and something that I actually learned about this film was that, one of the things that I was looking forward to, and I knew I was potentially going to have to pitch this, but maybe not, was I knew that when we were inside the ship, we were going to have, HDR was going to grant us the benefit of seeing detail out those little windows that just would have looked weird if I tried to bring them all the way back down. It just would have looked wrong in SDR if I just tried to get a blue sky out of something that is so many stops over. Because we wanted the inside of the ship to feel very real, not lit, because it wasn't. And so what I found, so I tried to explain this. Normally, if I'm doing a demonstration, it's a little easier to communicate. But I'm trying to explain to Shelley that he should think about HDR as looking identical to SDR for the first approximately 100 nits, a little less, where it's just the roll off that we're going to re-expand and not roll it off to an arbitrary white. Right. And so when I got him on board with that, I'm like, listen, the movie's going to look the same, except the highlight detail will keep going. And we can decide how much we want them to keep going. And him not being there because this is COVID. That was something that a lot of trust had to be placed and it's hard to sell that without him actually seeing it. And so as we matured through the process, so to be clear, we were doing I was bouncing between P3 in the theater, that's what we started with, to HDR trim because that's going to be our new hero. But Shelley is going to be spending his time on an iPad at home doing an SDR. So I actually am going to color in Rec 709.
Oh my God.
Knowing that I'm going to re-expand out to a hero HDR once he can actually view it that way. And that'll be ultimately my hero deliverable.
And are you already in Dolby Vision? And you're
straight in Dolby Vision.
Dolby Vision.
But I'm not, but I, at this point, I'm just doing SDR through a SDR LUT. I'm not doing it through Dolby Vision. I'm not juggling both that workflow right now.
Okay.
Because I know I'm going to get there later. But the mission here is, how do I make sure that I'm preserving the creative integrity of the conversations we're having during these virtuals while technically not limiting myself technically to get the most amount of detail that's going to look amazing in HDR down the line? I mean, this is adding a whole new wrench in the HDR workflow that already has a couple of wrenches from a creative perspective or a client salesmanship perspective, I suppose. And so you can imagine why a color scientist in this role is literally a superhero wearing a cape. If I could have drawn up a cape for them, I would have. I mean, that is like, can you think of another example where a color scientist would be a better friend than in this situation right here?
Yeah.
And to continue making progress on this film. And I tell you, it was seamless, completely seamless, moving from HDR to from P3 to HDR to a translation that I was happy with, that I was ready to pitch as soon as I could show him. But in the meantime, working under a Rec 709, a Gamma 2, like an SDR, Gamma 2, 2.4 LUT, coloring the film, re-expanding out to HDR for when he can actually see it in HDR. And
how did he see it in HDR
out.
Finally? What did you do for
that?
Yeah,
eventually we got him over to the Sony lot. Where we're doing a virtual, where he could see it on the same screen that I was. At the very, very, very end of the process, when this whole movie is colored, he finally got to come in for some supervised sessions right before the movie was released. But you can imagine how much trust had to be built up and how dialed your workflow had to be to not surprise the DP for those final sessions.
Wow, man, what a drama. What a drama off screen.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm going to go watch it a little bit more now that you're saying these interior scenes. You know, I'm going to actually try to watch it a little bit more. I really love that. You know, when I hear a little bit about the movie, I like to go back and just kind of rewatch it. Just sometimes I see so much more, you know, when I like watch it with a different eye, you know, because like, it's, you know, like when you watch a movie first time, you're so into the movie, but then second time you can maybe switch off and look for look, you know. But that for me is always like a, you know, like I always feel like if I watch a movie and look just for the looks, then there's a problem with the movie. I want to watch a movie without thinking about the look, you know, first time, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
But it went so down so well. I actually think that movie, and was this not nominated for anything?
That's right. Yeah, it was nominated for color correction by the HPA. So I mean, talk about the ultimate, you know, validation right there that this whole thing worked out. It did not need to work out this well. But I'm so proud of the film the way it did. My proudest achievement.
I think, you know, that it's amazing what you have achieved for your, you know, 29, you know, unbelievable, mate. And I actually think, and you know, like, and if there was one thing that, you know, anybody can take away from this conversation is that you didn't definitely do it just by sitting on your bum. I mean, just the amount of hours you were putting during your university and your studies, you know, and working, you know, it just shows you have to put hours in and do a lot of work if you want to get some results back. So I think you earned yourself every single nomination, you know, like through hard work and long hours.
Thank you.
You know, and you know what? I would love to see you do more of this kind of, you know, feature and episodic TV shows, simply because I feel like, you know, that what you bring to the table is something that stylistically is going to talk to the right audience, if you know what I mean. Like you definitely, you know, have an approach that is specific, you know, for the type of audience that you've been, you know, catering for through the music videos. And I really hope that it's not just going to be me, but other directors, producers, and cinematographers who will see that in your work and will want you to do and give their, you know, features and TV series more of that polish that you definitely know, you know, how to deliver. And because I think, you know, like as you grow as an artist, as you know, I think, you know, the challenges, you need to grow your challenges, and the challenges will grow with jobs like Greyhound, if you know what I mean. Like, you know, they, you know, I really hope you will get some, you know, bigger challenges and bigger jobs that will make your life even more exciting and interesting. Not that you have a boring life at all. And that we're going to see you progress even further. I don't think we've seen the best of your work. I think you're just about to become, you know, start shining, you know, and I'm going to be looking out for every film that you grade, and I'm going to be very curious to see what you're doing with it. And you know what, you know, such a pleasure. You know, you definitely, you know, are a person that definitely knows how to control the room. You control this conversation so well.
A little double edged.
And I want to, I would, you know, like one thing that I have to tell you, like, you know, a good colorist makes you feel like you really want to spend time with them and work with them. I have to tell you, this is one of the biggest kind of things that I actually kind of find. This is common for really amazing talent. You know, you feel like, I really like the guy or girl, I would love to work with him. And you're like 110%. You're, you know, level 11 on that. So please keep me informed as well. If you do something again, you know, like, you know, I would love to, you know, keep following you. I'm kind of your, you know, Instagram follower as well, by the way.
So. Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, hey, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. You know, listen, what you have just given us is like an incredible window into what went into your life so far and what goes in your head and how you work.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what we all needed. I think the kind of colorist communities really get to know you better. And thank you for being like that. Thank you for being so open and honest with this and such entertaining, actually, as well. I can't believe. And I hope, you know, we'll catch up, you know, maybe in person, you know, one day.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your evening. Thank you for your time, you know, and good luck with your endeavors. But this is all I can say.
You too. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Brian, enjoy. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you very much for tuning in. And if you would like to hear more of content like this, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. We will be bringing more insightful conversations on a weekly basis. And if you have a desire to get involved closer with the Color Lovers community, go and check out color.training, where we gather and learn and share our knowledge and thoughts. There are some fantastic courses, but also a Discord server where, you know, you can find some like-minded people and get some more of cool and interesting things like this one.